Okay. Well, first of all, do I need this? Yes. Can you hear me? Yes. Good. All right. Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation. There is a workshop tomorrow where a lot of the issues that I'm going to be raising here will also be discussed, because there's not going to be that much time for me to give the presentation. I'll speak for about 20 minutes or so, maybe 25 minutes, but there's a lot to cover here because I guess I sort of understand this issue from a much broader perspective, I think, than we've seen so far. And this has to do basically with what the future of humanity is in light of all the transformations that science and technology have been putting us through, okay? Let me just give you a little bit of background before I launch into this. What I have presented here on the screen, it's only in a couple of pages, is basically a kind of roadmap for thinking about the future of humanity. And before I get to that, I want to say how I have come into the topic. About 10 years ago, I was part of a European Union project to study the Converging Technologies agenda. Right, so we're talking about nanotechnology, biotechnology, information science and technology, and cognitive science, and the ways in which these disciplines, if they're sort of brought together and mobilized, can end up transforming, and actually the word enhancing gets used, enhancing the human condition to sort of take us to the next level, as it were. And there were a lot of motivations for this on both sides of the Atlantic. So this was an initiative originated in the United States in 2002 from the National Science Foundation, but also it got picked up within 2 years in Europe. And there are all kinds of motivations for trying to, quote, enhance human beings. Okay, make human beings live longer, you know, be smarter, all this kind of stuff. I got into this about 10 years ago, and in my own mind, it seemed to me that this was very much about the future of humanity, where there's an interesting kind of relationship that's developing between our biology and our technology. Okay, and this is kind of where the starting point is. And so, if you look up here, you'll see that the first question I have is, What is human exceptionalism after Darwin? Okay, so I'm going to start from the biological side. Because one of the things that Darwin has done with the theory of evolution is that the theory of evolution basically makes human beings just one among other animal species. In fact, the more and more we learn about animals, the closer and closer they seem to be to us. Okay, so whatever exceptionalism, you know, the human beings are the smartest or whatever kind of most advanced, most progressive creatures, from a purely biological standpoint, all of these issues are being challenged. And of course, you add to this the sorts of issues that we face as a species with regard to global warming and environmental problems. And so you get a lot of people on the biological side actually questioning whether we're so smart. Okay, so there's a sense in which human beings might not even be particularly well adapted to Earth. Okay, so there's a question after Darwin and after the general sort of evolutionary turn in biology as to what makes humans different. Okay, now some people say no, there is really no difference, that there's a sense in which human beings, you know, Darwin's basically right, there is no difference. We may be better at certain things, worse than others, but there's no absolute superiority. And so this position gets called post-humanism, right? Because basically we're talking about whatever value there is in the world or in reality, it is not centered on the human. It is beyond the human. It's somewhere else. Maybe it's life. Okay, that might be the value. But of course then there are other people, and it's the other people who I want to focus on, the transhumanists, which basically want to kind of take what has been historically seen as distinctive about humans and magnify it and amplify it as much as possible, even if that means we end up creating a lot of distance between what it means to be human and our biological past. And this is where technology comes in, okay? Because technology potentially has this power. And something about transhumanism that's worth pointing out is that this term, which is now kind of current, I would say for the last 10 years, people have been using it a fair amount, very often in connection with things like Ray Kurzweil talking about the singularity, that we're going to merge with machines and all of this, but also with regard to the extending longevity of life, right? That we may never need to die, that side of things on the biological side. All of these things are connected with transhumanism. I'll say a little bit more about them shortly. But the term itself was coined by Julian Huxley, okay, the evolutionary biologist, in the 1950s. And he was very much concerned, as all of these Huxleys, from Thomas Henry Huxley, Darwin's friend, to all of them, have all been concerned, what is it that makes human beings different? And so what Julian Huxley came up with, which is the basis for his coinage of transhumanism, is that all creatures obey evolution, but we're the only ones who know the theory. We know evolution. We know how it works. We have a second order understanding, right? It's one thing to just obey evolution, but it's another thing to actually know it, because if you know it, you can then steer it. You can direct it. You can give it some focus, some purpose. Okay? And Julian Huxley, over the course of his career, which was quite long, he only died in the 1970s, right, was involved with things like eugenics. He was sympathetic to cybernetics. He was sympathetic to a lot of these movements that actually would have human beings take control of life processes in a fairly direct way. Okay, and that's the origin of the term transhumanism. Transhumanism these days doesn't quite have that strong top-down emphasis, but nevertheless, the general sentiment that we can somehow steer or control, right, the processes of life, especially the processes of our own life, is very much part of what transhumanism is. So the question then arises, if you're going to take transhumanism seriously, is whether our biology is essential to our humanity. Now you might think, well, obviously the answer is yes. But this is not so clear, okay? In other words, you can be an evolutionist, right, and believe that human beings are in fact these upright apes who evolved over millions or billions of years. But once we have reached this point, where do we go from here? Do we remain in the ape-like bodies? Do we just try to change aspects of the ape-like bodies, like our ape-like genes? Or do we start thinking about more exotic possibilities, as it were, new platforms on the basis of which we can exercise our humanity? And this is where the whole idea of uploading consciousness and getting into a humanity 2.0 mode, where we, in a sense, gradually move from the carbon base to a silicon base. Right? And so, in other words, the things that have distinguished us historically from the animals, which is our humanity, can perhaps be better manifested in a machine than in an animal. This is a possibility. Okay? So when we talk about humanity 1.0, this is a term I use. I've written a book called Humanity 2.0, which is sort of about this transhumanism stuff. But humanity 1.0 is humanity in the biological body of Homo sapiens, in the upright ape. That's humanity 1.0. Right? And when we and most people, when they talk about things like, you know, human rights and human dignity and concern about human beings, they're referring to that creature. But there's an open question as to whether that creature is either necessary or sufficient for what counts as a human in the future. And this is the kind of open question that transhumanism poses. Okay? So here I want to bring up two different ways in which one can be a transhumanist. One in which you actually have human beings staying in the biological body of Homo sapiens, and the other where you basically have this kind of plan of moving into some more silicon base, either partially in the case of cyborgs, right, where we get some silicon chips implanted, some prosthetic devices, but we still have the biological body in some sense, or a complete uploading of the human personality or consciousness, like Ray Kurzweil talks about. Okay? So I'm going to give you, so if you know about transhumanism, it's interesting because these two projects, the project of extending life, human life, so that we can live for hundreds of years because somehow our genes manage to repair themselves, that this possibility sits right alongside the possibility that we might be uploading our consciousness into machines. They're both called transhumanist, but their strategies are really quite different. So there is this thing called the Methuselah Project. In the Bible, Methuselah was the oldest of the patriarchs. He died at the age of 900 and something. And this is a project in California. Aubrey de Grey, who was originally a computer scientist, English computer scientist, now runs this foundation that basically publicizes and conducts some research on extending human life indefinitely. Okay? But then on the other hand, we have the kind of Ray Kurzweil scenario. Now you might think, well, the idea that we can upload consciousness into machines, we hardly know what consciousness is at all, how are we going to upload it, right? I mean, that's obviously a question, but of course, very often what people mean when they say consciousness in this context, and I think Kurzweil means this, is they're talking about intelligence in some sense, which can be understood, you know, in some kind of computational form, and this is why Moore's law is so relevant to this project of singularity. The thing I want to say about the Singularity Project, however plausible or implausible you think it is, nevertheless, there is an attractiveness to it, okay? In other words, people are investing a lot of money into this, and part of the reason is because we live in a time where the intuitions that inform the singularity perspective are actually quite strong. In other words, the more and more you spend time online, and you're creating cyber identities and avatars and things like this, the easier it is to actually imagine oneself, right, as a being generated from a machine. This is actually getting easier and easier, and people are interacting with the machines as if they were people. And so this idea that one might completely go into some kind of silicon form is not so strange. I don't think it's as strange as it was 50 years ago. Even if the science isn't there yet, there is kind of the will and the ambition for it now in a way it wasn't before. Now, let me see if I can get this moving down a bit. Now, it's interesting when you look at the, I really think when we talk about the different options for transhumanism, I always think that one interesting kind of precedent for these two options comes from the history of technology. And in fact, it's one of the most widely discussed kinds of episodes, namely the invention of the automobile, which is, you know, especially if we talk about it in the Henry Ford sense, where we're talking about an entire shift in kind of business culture and orientation to personal transport. And in fact, you know, Joseph Schumpeter uses Ford as his paradigm case of creative destruction of markets, okay? Now, the interesting thing about the automobile episode is that you might say, when it came to personal transport, you in principle had two options. One option was to actually breed better horses. Horses that can actually, you know, they can ride for longer, don't need to be fed so much, right? I mean, in today's terms, this might actually have been the way to go. But of course, you know, the biology wasn't quite there at the time. And so instead you went to this other option, which was basically to reconceptualize the object from scratch in terms of its functionalities. In other words, what is it that you want out of personal transport when it gets down to it? Right? The horse has been providing it for you, but what is it about the horse that's so attractive? And you start thinking about speed and durability, and you start laying out all of these properties, and then you begin to realize, if that's what I want, I don't need an animal at all. I can go to this machine. Okay? And so this is where the creative destruction of the marketplace comes in, because you're no longer driven by the form of the entity. So in other words, the horse isn't driving your conception of personal transport, that it has to be some kind of horse. No, you're understanding personal transport in terms of fundamental principles and functions, and then you develop something that corresponds to that. And this, it seems to me, the people who want to go the singularity route, which with regard to uploading consciousness and all of that, they're kind of reconceptualizing human beings from scratch in just that way. In other words, what is it about humans that is so distinctive and so exceptional? And the answer does not necessarily mean that it has to be an animal. It could be a kind of machine. Okay? Now this has obviously implications. So even if we don't actually upload our consciousness into machines, this point obviously has implications for when we are developing more intelligent and sophisticated machines that we interact with. Because down the road, and already there's been discussions of ideas like machine rights. Like we have animal rights issues, we've got machine rights issues. And so at the end of 2013, I gave a talk at a conference at Yale University called, Personhood Beyond the Human. And this was the first time where you had people defending human rights, animal rights, and machine rights. And let me tell you, those rights get defended on very different grounds. And it's very interesting, and this is one of the things that we need to think about in terms of how our societies are organized in the future, is, what kinds of combinations can we live with? If we're actually going to think seriously about giving rights to all these different entities, okay? Because they're coming from many different directions here. So that's kind of part of the backdrop. The one other thing I want to say is a kind of historical note about the development of transhumanism and why it is that people who are interested in extending our lives indefinitely in the human body, and those who are interested in uploading consciousness into machine, why are they on the same side? Why are they, because they are actually proposing quite different things about the future of humanity, but they are somehow on the same side. Well, the answer comes from our dear friend George W. Bush. Okay? George W. Bush convened shortly after he began his presidency in 2001, a bioethics panel, which has been very influential in defining issues, you might say the limit issues, on what can be done in science and technology with regard to human beings. So as you know, one of the consequences of this panel's first report was the banning of federal stem cell research in the United States. Okay? The panel generally had a very conservative view about humanity, and basically believed and was quite explicit that there is something called human nature, and it's kind of like an essence of humanity, and it is in a way tied with our biological bodies, but kind of understood in a fairly reified fashion, right? In other words, ignoring the fact that the human body itself has changed quite a lot over the last 40,000 years. Okay, but nevertheless, they have this kind of biologically based notion of human nature, kind of thing that you might have found in Aristotle, for example. Okay, and of course, one of the things that they pushed was this thing that you probably know about from the environmental literature called the precautionary principle. Okay, and the precautionary principle basically says, err on the side of caution. In other words, if there are innovations whose consequences we are not fully on top of and may actually cause substantial harm, then do not do it. Okay? And there was, generally speaking, a kind of precautionary attitude toward a lot of biomedical innovation, and this is where the objections to stem cell research came from. So in response to that, in 2004, all of these transhumanists, even though they hold quite different views on the future of humanity, nevertheless, they all opposed George W. Bush's bioethics panel. And so they signed this thing called the Proactionary Principle Manifesto. Okay? And the Proactionary Principle says basically the exact opposite of the Precautionary Principle. In other words, it says that risks are not to be interpreted as threats, but as opportunities. And in fact, science and technology would not have brought human beings to where we are now. Admittedly, a very dangerous place, but nevertheless a place we are, where we are sort of very dominant, very far away from our animal roots. If science and technology did not take substantial risks along the way. In other words, if we actually had the ethical regulations that we currently have with regard to the introduction of innovation in science and technology, we would not be where we are now with regard to progress. Okay? And this is the thing. This is a very controversial point, but this is a very kind of key part of the pro-actionary agenda. How much more time do I have?
Soon 20 minutes. So you have 10 more minutes.
Altogether, yeah. I want to do open it up for questions. I mean, I do hope at least some of you will come to the workshop tomorrow, because in a sense, what follows are kind of the substantive, ethical, political issues that arise if one starts taking transhumanism seriously and one starts taking the pro-actionary principle seriously as a kind of basis on which to do science and technology policy, okay? And in this 2 pages that I've presented up here, I actually lay out 7 different challenges, okay? And I don't think there will be time here to talk about all 7 of them. I hope you do go to the workshop, because there will be time to discuss things. But given what's been said so far today, what I've understood, I want to focus on one of them before ending. And that's the 6th one, F. The superintelligent machines. Okay? Now, because I think this was alluded to a couple of times already, and this is an idea that has gotten a lot of attention in the UK especially. Basically, there are some institutes that are funding research into the possibility that computers may become so intelligent at some point, right, that they end up eliminating us. And why do they eliminate us? Well, they don't eliminate us because they're evil machines or something, or that, you know, they want to take advantage of us or something. That's a very science fiction way of looking at it. But the main reason that's proposed, and this is where it starts to get sort of interesting, is it's a kind of unintended consequence of the machines working normally. Okay? So in other words, if you design a machine that is supposed to, in the example that's used, there is this a transhumanist philosopher at Oxford, Nick Bostrom, who's proposed this thought experiment. And the idea is, let's say you program a machine that is designed to collect all the paper clips in the world. Okay? And one of the things about this machine is that the machine learns about its learning. Okay, so it has a kind of reflexive cognitive capacity built in, so it gets better and better and more efficient at doing this over time. And so one of the consequences of this, which is just a direct kind of epistemological consequence, not a moral consequence, is that the machine learns that human beings get in the way of the paperclips. Right? And when the machine does the calculations, it realizes that if there were no human beings, all those paperclips would be, you know, we could pick them up immediately. And so all you need to do is get rid of the human beings. And then the machine proceeds to do this, right? Now, so the thing here is, so the idea basically, and this is where I think maybe some of this stuff about the wise computing that you guys talk about comes in, right? That somehow the issue is about programming the machine, right, and our understanding the machine in such a way that this catastrophe doesn't happen. I'll tell you, I don't know how seriously you take this, but there's a lot of people worrying about this problem, okay? Now, the one thing I want to say about this problem, I myself think it's a little overrated, certainly with, you know, compared to global warming and things like this. But nevertheless, I do think the interesting thing is that by the time we would actually have such a machine that could do something like this, I think there would be an open question about whether all human beings would be on the same side. Okay? In other words, the way this scenario is set up, it's as if human beings are somehow by nature more aligned and more affiliated with other human beings, rather than, let's say, machines they interact with a lot or animals they interact with a lot. And as a matter of fact, if you imagine when such a machine might be created, let's say 50 years from now, given already how much exposure and how much interaction and how much meaning human beings invest in their dealings with computers, it is certainly reasonable to suppose that if we had super intelligent machines, there would be human beings helping them out. Okay? And so it seems to me this is kind of more of the issue on the table here with regard to the identity of our humanity, right? Because as we go more and more down this singularity route, okay, then one of the things that happens, of course, is it becomes easier and easier to identify with machine life. And so when these kinds of scenarios that are being projected would come along, then it might not seem so bad because there would be humans already helping the computers out, already on their side. Perhaps they'd even be people who are kind of mobilizing for machine justice because machines are discriminated against which in the society. All of these things are possible. Because we already have people talking about machine rights, even before the machines have gotten this sophisticated. Okay? So it seems to me that, you know, when we talk about the future of humanity in light of these issues having to do with advanced computers and information technology and stuff like that, we have to keep close tabs on where the identity of the human is in all this and exactly where the boundary is going to be drawn in the future, the more and more, you know, the human identity is actually tied together with computer and cyber identities. So I think I'll stop here and open it up to some questions. Is that possible? How much time do we have?
You have about five more minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes, so I can take some questions. Well, thank you. Come to the workshop tomorrow.
Guess I'm here. My name is Tokumaru. I'm from Remote Sensing Technology Center of Japan. You said that we are one of animals. But in Descartes, he compared human and animals as a different concept.
Yes, yes.
And most of the people still follow Descartes. How do you think about that?
Well, it is interesting. Actually, Descartes is getting a revival now, I think, because of all of this computer stuff. There's no doubt about it. No, I don't think that Descartes' reputation has never been higher in recent times. And it is a direct challenge to the Darwin view. See, I'm starting from the Darwin view because maybe I'm wrong, but I guess I always kind of thought that scientific people these days think of human beings as Homo sapiens, kind of an upright ape. But you're right. I think that the mood is shifting toward Descartes, in which case it's a kind of open question. By the way, I actually welcome this shift. I actually welcome the shift. Yeah.
Thank you for a very stimulating discussion. I'm Hide Tokuda from Keio University. We happen to have a special issue on information processing, special issue on singularity this year, uh-huh. January. We had a special issue. We have two sides of coin. One is very positive, like as you said, mm-hmm. Humanity 2.0. The other one is more traditional way. We never change our human society in nature. So I just wonder, in the UK, people are very positive towards the humanity 2.0, or rather more people are comfortable with humanity 1.0?
I think it's a complex situation. I think most people prefer humanity 1.0, but I think most people also think that things are changing. So in other words, I think if you ask people why are they attached to humanity 1.0 in Britain, I think relatively few of them would talk about a sort of human nature essence of humanity, but rather they'll talk about, you know, something like, well, this is kind of what we understand. This is the basis of our notions of dignity and, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. But it would be a much more, you might say, cultural or sociological kind of reason for sticking to humanity 1.0. But I think everybody, at least, you know, a lot of this stuff is coming from Britain, it's true, but I think there is a greater and greater sense that what humanity means is up for grabs. Right? I mean, I think that's the issue. And that's why singularity is an important thing to talk about, regardless of whether one thinks, you know, it's going to happen or it's right or whatever. And I think that's quite a striking thing. And I think never before have the options on the table been so diverse about the future of humanity, where in a sense, you've got kind of a clear distinction between continuing on as a biological creature, maybe one who lives longer and lives healthier, or uploading into a machine and continuing that way. You see, I don't think before we've ever had distinctions quite so stark, you know, and that's why we end up having, as it were, Darwin and Descartes on equal playing field. That's also, you see, I don't think that certainly wasn't true 25 years ago.
Thank you. Thank you.